My name is Liza Mills. I'm 43 years old. Today is September 11th, 2018. I'm speaking with Julia Hirsch, who is my mother. We are recording this interview in New Paltz, New York.
My name is Julia Hirsch. I am 80 years old. I am recording this interview in New Paltz, New York. I'm speaking with Liza Mills, who is my daughter.
Can you tell me about an early memory from your childhood?
One of my earliest memories must be from when I was 3 years old, standing on the deck of a Portuguese ship, which strangely enough had a French name, Guinée, meaning Guinea, as in the country. And I am attached to a harness held by someone in the family and looking out at the ocean. This is the boat that is taking us from Lisbon in Portugal to New York City, where we arrived in April 1941.
Can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
I was my parents' third child, and given their generation, they were relatively old when I was born. My father was 45 and my mother was 36. My father was a very erudite man who had grown up with incredible privilege, but had never learnt the concept of earning a living. That was a bit of a liability in coming to America. My mother was similarly spoiled in many ways. She was raised to be a lovely lady who knew fine linens and fine china. She knew something about art and music, but she didn't have much of a practical bone in her body.
Can you tell me your parents' names?
My father's name was Menko Max Hirsch. My mother's name was Sophia Prince. That was her maiden name. And when she married my father, she became Sophia Hirsch.
And what was your relationship with your parents like?
Hard to describe. My mother was my main caregiver. She was a little bit erratic in paying attention, but she was, I think, as loving a parent as she could be. My father was quite remote and self-absorbed, but on occasion, he showed up for me in very sweet ways.
Can you tell me about a nice memory you have of your father?
My father modeled scholarship and the love of reading, but that only had an influence on me much later in life. A very early memory I have is from when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and a classmate gave me a hamster as a pet. I was terrified of this hamster, and which made it kind of silly for me to have it, but my father thought it was a good thing for me to have a pet and tried to get me to be less afraid of the hamster. So he would take it out of the cage and hold it in his hand and encourage me to stroke its back. Initially, he had to do this by holding my finger and, you know, doing it sort of for me. And by, I overcame my fear and got to enjoy my hamster. But I think...
What was his name?
I had two of them. The first one was Mitzi, who died within the year that I had her. And the second one, I can't remember, I can't remember the name right now, but that one also suffered an early death. I don't know what the life expectancy is of a hamster, so maybe they lived their full hamster life. But my parents both dealt very, very tactfully with the death of these pets. I never actually saw the dead hamster. It deceased while I was at school. And they told me a nice story about how the dead hamster had been disposed of. I suspect they took it to a garbage can outside the house and disposed of it that way. But I never asked.
Can you tell me a nice memory of your mother?
I have lots of nice memories of my mother, who was very good at coming up with delightful things to do. She was not so good at the reality of life. But a delightful memory I have of her is a trip that we took in summer to Bear Mountain. It was a family trip with my mother, brother, and sister, and I don't remember if my father was there, but we took out a rowboat and sat on the rowboat. And in the middle of the lake, my mother came up with the idea, which she obviously had anticipated, of making paper boats out of colored paper and floating them in the lake. This was a lot of fun until we realized that this was probably not a good idea because we were basically polluting the lake with these goofy boats. And I think what happened was we then went back to the boats and picked them up again. But I remember clearly the fun of seeing these little paper boats sailing away.
Tell me what you remember of the house you grew up in.
I grew up in an apartment on 97th Street in Manhattan between Riverside and West End, apartment 2N. It was at the back of the house and it was very dark. It overlooked an alleyway full of ailanthus trees. The apartment itself was very dark and crowded. It was too small for 5 people, but we somehow managed to live in it. In reality, it was probably gloomy and furnished with hand-me-down furniture. I don't know from where. But I think of it very lovingly as a wonderful home, even though it's associated with difficult memories. And if I were to visit it today, I would probably find it incredibly shabby.
Did you have your own room?
No, I shared a room with my sister, who was very resentful of having to share with me. The back of that story is that she was jealous of our brother, who was 2 years her senior, because he had his own room. She didn't quite understand that there was a kind of gender logic to this, like a little girl shouldn't be sharing a bedroom with a much older brother who was a teenager. And since she was a girl and I was a girl, that made sense. But she certainly wasn't happy about my sharing the room with her and allowed me very little space, both geographic and emotional, in that room.
Tell me a little more about your siblings. What were their names? And
my brother's name was Abraham Hirsch. He was born in 1927. In Halberstadt and died in 1994 in Silver Spring, Maryland. In my early childhood, he was a kind of remote but very friendly person. He didn't play with me, though he sometimes engaged me in playful conversation. Since he was almost 11 years my senior, he was already a teenager when I first became aware of him, but basically he registered as a nice guy. I was also aware from a young age that he had many, many interests that kept him busy. He became a Zionist at a young age and was very involved in a Zionist youth movement. My sister, who was 3 years his junior, was born in 1930 in Berlin. Her name is Lily Hirsch, that was her birth name, and she married a Mr. Krakowski in 1956. She tried very hard when I was little to educate me. She felt I think subliminally, or maybe not so subliminally, that my mother was not educating me enough. So, for instance, she made a point of taking me to the public library and telling me what books to read. The books she had me read were generally books on the 8th or 9th grade reading list at the junior high school she went to, but that was okay because I could handle that. She often, in her zeal to educate me, she was often very strict, if not sadistic, and she took to beating me up and punishing me for things that I really did not understand. I remember once wanting to skip up and touch the awnings of apartment buildings on West End Avenue the way I had seen other girls do, and she gave me quite a yelling at for doing that and told me that was the wrong thing to do. I'm not sure if she was repeating the practices she'd learned from her German nanny or whether she just hated my guts because I was a pesky little sister and didn't bring her much joy. But that kind of tension between possibly benevolent concern but also angry disdain punctuated our relationship and still does. For the last 40 years, she's lived in a remote part of Herkimer County in New York, a place that's very hard to reach without a car, and even with a car is hard to reach.
So where were you born?
I was born in Antwerp, Belgium on January 1st, 1938.
And can you tell me about what happened between the time that you were born and, you know, where did you live until you came to the United States, and how old were you when you came to the United States?
I evidently lived the first 2 years and 5 months in a very large house in Antwerp, a house that I happily was able to take you to visit a few years ago, a house that was located at 26th Avenue Bosmans, a very patrician and enormous house in a neighborhood of huge patrician houses. We left that house on May 10th, 1940, which was the day that the Germans invaded Belgium. My parents were completely unprepared for such an event, which had been anticipated, and ended up walking through occupied France for a number of months. I have no conscious recollection of this time, except that I was not with them. I was taken someplace else by my nanny and separated from my parents. And I really don't know what happened to me, except that I have a very severe startle reflex, which may be the result of exposure to bombings. The Germans strafed the roads in France as they were trying to invade France, and the roads were full of refugees fleeing Belgium and France as the Germans were entering the country. Eventually, my parents and my nanny, who was also in the presence of my mother's parents and an uncle, were reunited someplace in France, and I stayed with my parents, and the nanny, the grandparents, and the uncle went back to Antwerp. At some point, I don't know when, we ended up in a suburb of Lisbon in Portugal. We stayed there for the better part of 6 months, trying to figure out the next step in our journey. My parents wanted to go to Palestine, but the British, who were then the occupying force in Palestine, decreed that they didn't want any more Jews from occupied Europe. And my father was able to buy, I don't know how, Cuban citizenship, which allowed us to enter the United States and get around the prohibition that had also been instated in the United States against accepting any more Jewish refugees from Europe. So we arrived in New York in April 1941 on the boat that I mentioned earlier in connection with my earliest memory.
But didn't you tell me that you lived in the UK for a period?
I did live in the UK, but that was very much later. I lived with my parents on 97th Street from 1942 to 1951. From 1941 to 1942, we first lived in a residential hotel, the Hotel Alcott on 72nd Street near Central Park. Then we moved into an apartment, 408 Central Park West, now underneath what is called Park West Village, for a while. And then we moved into the apartment at 311 West 97th Street, which I've mentioned earlier. After my father died, my mother went back, took me back to Antwerp to live with her father, who was then in his 80s, but still lived in the house where my mother had grown up. After a few months, my mother remarried, and we moved to England. We moved to London, where I lived until my stepfather died, and I could no longer stay in England and went back to America by myself.
Why couldn't you stay in England?
My stepfather, alas, also died bankrupt, and so there was really no more money. There was no money to send me to university, which is what I wanted. As an American citizen, I couldn't get free tuition to any English university, nor could I get work. I couldn't get working papers. So there was no place for me to go other than to go back to America, where I could earn money and I could go to school.
Did you miss anything, or do you miss anything about Europe?
Lots.
What do you miss?
It was very hard for me to get used to America when I came back here at the age of 18, because at that time, in the 50s, England was still very different than it is today. England was not as diverse. It was not particularly cool. And I went to a school in which I ended up feeling quite at home. It was an all-girls school. So when I came back to America, I found that I didn't know any of the social behaviors that other 18-year-olds were familiar with, anything from taking care of myself to getting on with boys, to how to do academic work in an American classroom. And it was all a big puzzlement and difficult for me to adjust. Eventually, I learned, but still today I feel that I've missed out on some phase of American socialization. I also missed my stepfather's children, who had become very close, who had been very kind to me and made me feel part of a family. And I missed my friend Liz, who was my first experience of having a very close friend. And thank God we somehow have managed to stay just as close over all these years.
Can you tell me a little bit about your career?
Oh my. I don't remember consciously choosing my career, but I do remember that from a young age, even when I still lived on 97th Street, I loved reading. I loved writing. And when I was at school in England, I learned a lot of skills having to do with reading and writing. My parents never showed any interest in asking me what did I want to do when I grew up, or preparing me for the very idea that when I grew up I was supposed to do something. My mother did instill in me that when I grew up I was supposed to marry a rich man, but that didn't appeal to me in the least. And the school I went to in England, North London Collegiate School, really developed my love of reading, of writing, of researching, of all of the things connected to academic life. And without really sitting down and thinking about it much, I decided by the time I was 17 or 18 that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted a life of reading, writing, researching and talking about it. And at the time that I went to college in the late 50s, it was not at all difficult to sort of ease right into graduate school, postdoctorate, careers, graduate grants, fellowships. It was just an easy sort of yellow brick road, which is not at all the case now. So I sort of drifted or swam easily into my career and loved every bit of it, starting in getting degrees. I was very lucky that the first full-time job I applied for when I finished my doctorate became my lifetime career. That was, I started out at Brooklyn College in 1964 as an instructor with a brand new doctorate, and I retired, I don't remember when, I think in 2005 or 2006 as Professor Emerita in the English department.
So who were the major influences in your life?
Well, there were many influences in my life from different quarters. But in terms of what I still love to do today and how I construct my time, I would say two very, very different influences. One of them was my stepbrother, Julius Lunzer, who, thank God, is still alive and well at the age of 96, who modeled for me intellectual rigor and dedication to ideals. He also had a huge library of French and German literature that I made my way through as a teenager. And, you know, no one ever said to me, oh, you can't read that, you're too young. So I read my way through lots of 19th century French novels, a little bit of philosophy, and that was great. And also, he was and is someone who is rigorously ethical, and I greatly admire that. He is also someone who has been and continues to be dedicated to his family and has been a model father to his children, who are wonderful people. So that was a big influence, and still is a big influence on me. The second influence was a teacher at Columbia in graduate school. Oh no, there's another one. Two teachers that I met, one at Barnard, which I basically hated, but Eleanor Rosenberg was a woman who had made her way the hard way into academe. She had started as a high school teacher. She struggled for 30 years to complete a very original landmark doctorate in a field of research that was brand new at the time that she was trying to get into it. And she was very kind and very generous to me in helping me focus on applying to graduate school and having the courage to try something I was sure I would fail at. She also was a wonderful teacher. The second teacher was Marjorie Hope Nicholson, who taught in the graduate English department at Columbia, who was a formidable scholar and a brilliant lecturer. And I can still hear her voice today as she read some choice bits of 17th century English literature. What startled me about Professor Nicholson was that at some point in her life, having a doctorate in English, she decided she wanted to write about Isaac Newton. But in order to write about Isaac Newton, who discovered gravity and various things about light, she needed a degree in physics. So she went out and got a doctorate in physics. And then she wrote a number of very interesting and readable books about science and the imagination in the 17th century. But she also modeled rigor and dedication, and I really admired that.
Can you tell me about your first kiss? How old were you and where did it happen?
Well, it's a delightful buried memory because after my first kiss, there were quite a few others. Some memorable, some not memorable at all. I think that my first kiss happened when I was 17. It happened in a kitchen or in a hallway of a rather shabby apartment where my stepfather, my mother, and I had moved to after my stepfather sold the house in which we had lived. My father, grand-stepfather was a very orthodox and devout Jew, and he went to synagogue every Friday night. And it's a custom in Jewish practice that if you meet a stranger at the synagogue, you invite him to his house, to your house. So one night, my stepfather brought home this very charming man who was in his late 20s, and I took quite a liking to him. He was tall, blonde, handsome, American, and I don't know, I can't remember what charmed me about him, but he gave me, and I gladly returned my first kiss. This happened late at night after Shabbos in the kitchen when our parents were fast asleep and no one knew what mischief I was up to. But I was up to mischief.
What other mischievous things did you do as a kid?
I was an abysmally obedient child. And I think that's probably accounts for some of the flaws in my character. So I remember once sitting in the kitchen at apartment 311 West 97th Street. I was alone in the kitchen and we had a large enamel bread box. And for some reason, I had a fancy to take a fork and scribble on the lid of the enamel bread box. Of course, I didn't realize at the moment that I was destroying the lid of the bread box and making indelible marks on it. My sister found me and there was hell to pay. But I must confess that I remember with sort of delight the feeling of pushing the paint off the bread box with one of the tines of the fork. So that was mischief. I wasn't up to much mischief, and that's a shame. I missed that chapter in life. Probably later in life I caught up in inappropriate ways, but I'm not sure about that. I mean, I never stole anything. I never tried on my mother's lipstick. I never... what else could I have done?
A lot.
Well, I missed that part of childhood entirely.
How has your life turned out differently than you could have imagined?
Well, I mentioned that my parents never projected a future for me, other than my mother sort of assuming that the thing I had to do in life was to marry a rich husband and, you know, have a nice bourgeois life. I early felt there was something wrong with this goal because the parents I experienced were not the rich parents of Europe. They were the totally impoverished refugees of New York. So until much, much later in my life, I thought that all my mother's stories about how rich and powerful and prestigious the Hirsch family was just a crock. I did find out much later, like starting in the year, the 2000s, that it was true. They had once been all of those things. So I sort of bumbled along life, and until I had decided, you know, that I wanted to go to college and sort of lead a life of reading, writing, reflecting, researching, and talking about it when I was 16 is when I started having my college dreams. I never really thought about a future. Now, when I look back, I'm kind of amazed that, number one, I wasn't bombed to death on the road in France in 1940. I didn't die of polio in New York in the 1940s, where many children did before the Salk vaccine. I'm amazed that I managed to get through college. I managed to not starve to death. I managed to sort of visit many of the landmarks of life that we take for granted, not always with great success, such as marriage. I didn't do so well with that. I did have and do have two spectacular daughters, and I never expected that. I did have a career that brought me enormous satisfaction. I certainly didn't expect that at all, because I remember a high school teacher in North London, telling me I didn't know English. She was very anti-American, and so she thought, since I had learned English in America, I didn't know English. But that was really crushing. Anyway, I did end up, even though Miss Gossip said I didn't know English, becoming a professor of English and all of that. So I would say my life has turned out much better than I could ever have imagined it. I feel very blessed that I've lived to this age. I feel very blessed that I've seen my daughters grow up and have awesome lives and have wonderful children. I feel very blessed that I did meet someone I love dearly, and after being together for 6 years, I have no desire to leave him, and he evidently has no desire to leave me, so that looks good. I enjoy two wonderful homes, and I feel that I have more goodies, I have enjoyed more blessings than I could ever have imagined, and certainly more blessings than I could possibly ever deserve.
Thinking about your family many generations from now, and knowing they may hear this recording, is there anything you want to say to them? Any wisdom or advice you would like to share?
Yes. I think that what is most important is to live an ethical life. Material goods come and go and don't really make a person a good person, a bad person, or an indifferent person. But every day we have an opportunity to make ethical decisions. And I think that that is the most important thing we can do, to live our lives ethically, to be kind to others, to exercise charity to others as best we can, to show compassion and patience to others, both those near to us and those who seem alien, foreign, or maybe even disagreeable. The other thing I have found is that I often made mistakes when I failed to think through something. I was often impulsive and went with superficial, impulsive decisions rather than thinking things through. I think it's also very important to listen to your heart. Very often your heart knows things that your head tries to deny. And when I think of the mistakes I made, I know jolly well that my heart was telling me no when my head said yes. So listen to your heart. Being ethical, thinking things through, listening to your heart, it's all a balancing act. None of these things come easily, and it's always worth spending another hour, spending another week, spending another month, spending another year thinking something through before you make your final decision. And you will make mistakes. That's kind of goes along with being human. And when you do, try to be kind to yourself and try to be kind to others who have made mistakes towards you.
So we have a little bit more time. Is there anything that you would like to ask me that you've never asked me before?
How do you find the courage to do the amazing things you do, like climb up rocks or contemplate sailing across the Pacific for 20 days? Where does that courage come from? Because I feel that I totally lack courage about just about everything.
I think I have always functioned well when there's a sense of danger. And I just believe that fear doesn't need to be an obstacle to doing something that we've thought through and are passionate about and want in our lives. So when people say, oh, you're so brave. How are you not afraid of these things you do? Because I love adventure sports and have done some pretty wild things in my life so far. I just tell them that I am afraid. I just do it anyway. I just jump right in. And it's not that I'm feel that the things I'm doing now are particularly impulsive, but they are risky. And it makes me feel alive. I think that so many people go through life afraid, and through their fear, they don't do things that they say they want to do for fear of what might happen. But I truly believe that we only have the present moment that's right in front of us right now, and that to live in the past prevents us from being present in our lives, and to live in fear also prevents us from showing up and living our lives to the fullest. So I just feel that my courage is just moving forwards, just one day at a time towards the things I want to do, and also just trusting that God has a plan for me that I can't even quite fathom. So I just need to show up. And I like what you say about, you know, as long as I'm being ethical and treating people with love and showing up for people in my life, I want to experience everything I can. And I know that, you know, I'm 43 years old, so I know I'm not going to be a young person forever, and I still feel pretty young and able-bodied. So while I am young and able-bodied, I want to get the most out of this body that I can, and just enjoy the most experiences I can. So I am afraid, but I'm also just moving forwards and not letting my head get in the way of my heart's desires. Anything else?
No, I love you.
I love you too. Thank you. Thank you for doing this with me.
Oh, you're so welcome. Those were wonderful questions.